KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets every third Thursday at 5 o'clock p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the opening reception of Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. This event was originally scheduled for Friday, January 13th. Giving Back illustrates Black philanthropic experiences and giving traditions grounded in faith, mutuality, responsibility, and social justice. Images and stories are from the book Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African-American philanthropists. Again, that's the opening reception of Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in the final days of his term in office, President Obama has commuted the prison sentence of whistleblower Chelsea Manning, along with hundreds of others.
And Oregon citizens, activists, and politicians gather to protest the repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
And we sit down with Jobs with Justice to discuss their upcoming inauguration night event of music and organizing to fight the Trump agenda. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 17th, 2017. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. On Sunday, Democratic legislators and local politicians held a rally to stop the premature repeal of the Affordable Care Act, nicknamed Obamacare, in North Portland. Well over 1,000 citizens and activists attended the event, enough to fill the venue and leave a crowd outside the doors. U.S. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley spoke at the rally, as well as Congressional Representatives Kurt Schrader, Suzanne Bonamici, Earl Blumenauer, and Mayor Ted Wheeler. The recurring theme of the speakers' speeches was the importance of the public making their voice heard and the damage the repeal will cause.
The first three words of our Constitution are what?
We the people.
How about health care for we the people and not the insurance companies? Woo! How about health care for we, the people, not simply the rich who can afford insurance? How about health care for the poor, for the working people, for the seniors, for the children, for everyone, affordable quality health care throughout America? Let's get it done. Let's save it. Thank you.
Republicans are using the upcoming Trump administration as an opportunity to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Portland is under an ice storm warning through 10 p.m. Tuesday and a flood watch from 10 a.m. until early Thursday morning. National Weather Service meteorologists predicted light freezing rain to begin falling early Tuesday morning. They expect a break in late morning and early afternoon and then heavier precipitation late in the afternoon and evening. Portland's forecast calls for up to 3/4 inch of precipitation Tuesday night. Forecasters expect a daytime high near 36 degrees that will rise to around 38 by 9 p.m. tonight. The ice storm warning calls for up to 1/4 inch of ice accumulation around the region. Areas east of Interstate 205 could see up to 1/2 inch of accumulation. However, in some spots close to the Columbia River Gorge could get up to 1 inch of ice.
protesters stormed a store at the Lloyd Center on Monday that featured a t-shirt carrying a satire of words by President-elect Trump. The shirt was printed with words, "Grab America by the female genitalia," referring to the President-elect Trump's now infamous remarks recorded on an Access Hollywood bus in 2005. The demonstration was prompted by a photograph of the t-shirt that was circulated widely online. At the demonstration, a shirtless female protester grabbed Trump's wax figure by the crotch in a gesture of reciprocity. But Mary Newmare, who originally posted the photo of the t-shirt on Facebook, said she shared the image as a, quote, plea for decency. After posting the photo, she told a reporter that she had received a torrent of rape threats online. A spokesman for Spencer Gifts LLC, which sells the t-shirt, insisted it was intended as a, quote, satire, similar to Alec Baldwin's portrayal of President-elect Trump on Saturday Night Live. Spencer's has refused to stop selling the t-shirts, although the manager of the Oregon shop, which sparked the protest, reportedly moved them to the back of the store.
With the Injustice boycott nearly into its second phase, lead organizer Sean King has been using the campaign's platform to give voice to the voiceless. Since King launched the operation, he has used his resources to influence San Francisco District Attorney George Gaskin to charge officers involved in the killing of Almacar Perez Lopez with murder. King implored the public to use hashtags and other social media devices to apply pressure. Another way King has made it easier to get involved and make a difference is by encouraging his followers to retweet him. This has been used to target New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio in hopes of seeing to the closure of the Rikers Island prison complex. Bill de Blasio has found himself the recipient of countless emails from the Injustice Boycott campaign demanding that he fire Officer Daniel Pantaleo from the NYPD for the killing of Eric Garner. The Injustice Boycott played a major role at Standing Rock, North Dakota, in the efforts to defund the Dakota Access Pipeline. King and his supporters put pressure on the contingent of international banks supporting invested in the construction of the crude oil pipeline.
White House officials are preparing to hand over power 3 days ahead of the changing of the guard. Today, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest gave his final briefing to the correspondents who covered the executive branch. Shannon Young has more.
So even though it's my last day, you better not let up now.
Just as White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest was about to open the floor of the packed press room to questions in his final briefing, the man for whom he so often speaks took the stage without warning.
I am...
President Barack Obama's surprise appearance was filled with kind words for Earnest, who has worked for him since his first presidential campaign and been his press secretary since 2014. After Obama's exit, the briefing continued for more than an hour and a half. Many of the questions alluded to what can be expected after the transition of power and the transition itself.
To serve the American people is to make sure that the person that they've elected president of the United States has an opportunity to succeed and hit the ground running. And we have been challenged to do that in spite of our, in some cases, profound concerns with some of the rhetoric and policy positions that are being articulated by the other side.
Earnest dismissed concerns that plans to skip the inaugural ceremony announced by more than 40 members of Congress were fueling political polarization, saying instead it's merely a reflection of the division in the country. He went on to stress that the executive branch has been working behind the scenes to ensure a smooth transition of power.
Members of Congress have a different responsibility. They are freer to express their opinion in a way that they choose. They don't have the same kind of institutional responsibility that the administration has.
Just how White House press briefings may play out under a soon-to-be President Donald Trump remains to be seen. But Esquire reports plans are underway to close the iconic White House briefing room and move the events out of the presidential residence and office. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
President Barack Obama has commuted the 35-year sentence of Chelsea Manning. Manning, who was convicted for releasing military documents to the WikiLeaks organization in 2010, will be released on May 17th. This commutation was one of over 200 pardons and commutations announced by President Obama's office Tuesday afternoon. Manning, a transgender woman and former Army intelligence analyst, has been serving her sentence at an all-male Army prison in Kansas, where she has attempted suicide twice in the past year. After being refused medical care and put in solitary confinement for extended periods of time. In 2010, Manning leaked over 750,000 secret military documents to WikiLeaks, bringing widespread attention to the impact of war on civilians. Manning's 35-year sentence was unprecedented, and she is already the longest convicted whistleblower in the United States history. While several Republican members of Congress have expressed disappointment and outrage at Manning's impending release, Manning's lawyer at the ACLU said in a statement Tuesday that, quote, "This move could quite literally save Chelsea's life, and we are all better off knowing that Chelsea Manning will walk out of prison a free woman, dedicated to making the world a better place and fighting for justice for so many."
Immigrant workers in Chicago are reviving a protest tactic from 2006 to coincide with the inauguration of Donald Trump. FSRN's Teresa Campagna has more from Chicago.
What would it be like to live in the U.S. for one day without immigrants? That's one question organizer for immigrant worker rights, Jorge Mujica, aims to pose to the incoming Trump administration.
What we are doing is saying, okay, you don't like us? Then we will give you a taste of what it's like a country without immigrants.
Mujica, of the Arise Chicago Worker Center, is part of a local campaign urging immigrant workers to call in sick on January 20th and to avoid school and shopping. During the one-day action, Arise Chicago will hold workshops in the city's Pilsen neighborhood on how to prepare for immigration raids and confront hate crimes. The idea, says Mujica, is to show that immigrant workers are in the middle of society and that business as usual is impossible without the immigrant labor force and consumer base. A 2015 Pew Research report backs this up, finding that foreign-born workers make up about 17% of the national workforce and constitute a majority in sectors like domestic service and agriculture. Teresa Campagna, FSRN, Chicago.
The number of House Democrats planning to boycott Trump's inauguration grew to more than 40 on Tuesday. Representatives were protesting the president-elect's policies and his criticism of civil rights activist John Lewis. The Georgia congressman made headlines over the weekend for challenging Trump's legitimacy to be the next president. "I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton," unquote. He said this in an interview with NBC's Meet the Press. The number of Democrats boycotting Trump's inauguration continued to increase. It includes Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison, a top contender to lead the Democratic National Committee, as well as many Black and Hispanic lawmakers. On Tuesday, Democrats Alma Adams of North Carolina, Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania, and Carol Shea Porter of New Hampshire joined the boycott. Top Democrats such as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer of New York will attend, however, and none of the Senate Democrats said they'll skip the inauguration. Trump spokesman Sean Spicer shrugged off the protests and indicated they would give away the seats.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case on mandatory arbitration agreements. Workers are being forced to sign mandatory arbitration agreements that waive their rights to go to court as conditions of employment nationwide. These agreements take away worker rights to file lawsuits or, in some cases, to take disputes with the employers to the National Labor Relations Board. Federal labor law protects worker rights to go to court or the NLRB when employers are violating the law. Chicago and San Francisco federal courts upheld the workers refusing to sign the arbitration agreements. A New Orleans federal court did not. Now the U.S. Supreme Court will decide whether or not mandatory arbitration agreements forced on workers are legal or not. American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein says the U.S. Postal Service remains threatened by some who want to privatize it, and he says the people have to join the union in fending off privatization so America can retain universal postal service. Demenstein says preserving postal service for the American people is not and should not be a partisan political issue.
We got a lot of people around the country on both sides of the political aisle who look at the post office, as they should, as a nonpartisan issue, something that the people of this country have a right to and need. And let's face it, if postal services go private, if postal services are degraded, in many cases the areas that get hit the hardest are rural America. And the people of rural America are demanding from their representatives, from either or any party, that they want postal services that can produce, that can get those medicines there on time, and get those packages ordered online, they're on time. And that'll only happen if we have a good public postal service, the good publicly owned infrastructure, and the commitment to universal service that's ensconced in the Constitution.
New York's Environmental Conservation Commissioner says state officials expect to cite the Momentum chemical plant with environmental violations. Hundreds of workers with IUECWA Local 81359 are striking at Momentum. Recent meetings with the company failed to resolve strike issues. The state officials are concerned about chemical spills and hazardous waste handling, according to the Albany Times Union newspaper. There have been at least 38 spills at the plant since the strike started November 2nd, 2016. The striking workers say it's about fighting against a super-rich company that's trying to destroy the workers' standard of living, pensions, health care and benefits, and on-the-job safety and work rules.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org. Brought to you by Union Active, your certified iOS and Android mobile app developer, offering high-quality, union-made mobile apps backed by a support team which upgrades your product to every new mobile operating system. Features, pricing, and examples are online at unionactive.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Cutie Pock Talk at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Probably best to stay inside for the remainder of the day into tomorrow. Frozen rain is due to continue this afternoon and all the way through Wednesday. Oregon Department of Transportation officials announced the closure of a 45-mile section of the I-84 between Troutdale and Hood River. High winds along the roads frozen over will make for especially hazardous driving conditions in the greater Portland metro area. Philomath is looking at comparatively mild weather with consistent rain into the next couple of days and temperatures in the high 30s to low 40s. Today in history, in 1981, Philippine President Fernando Marcos lifted martial law after only 8 years of maintaining his authoritarian hold over the archipelago. Now, over 35 years later, standing Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has been carrying out thousands of extrajudicial killings of citizens grappling with drug addiction and those thought to be involved in the trade and sale of illicit drugs.
Since the fossil fuel divestment campaign began on university campuses in 2011, institutions worth $2.6 trillion have pulled their investments in coal, oil, and natural gas. The movement to demand financial institutions divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline, which began late last year, is still in the early stages. 17 banks, including Wells Fargo, SunTrust, and Citibank, are backing the pipeline. A recent protest in Seattle, led by Native leaders and water protectors, allies targeting Wells Fargo, shows the movement is gaining momentum. Wells Fargo has close to $500 million invested in the pipeline. FSRN's Martha Baskin has this report.
Members of the Standing Rock Sioux, West Coast, and Inland tribes, accompanied by non-native water protectors, entered a Wells Fargo bank in Seattle late last week, chanting and drumming before security officers locked the doors, preventing hundreds more from entering. Paul Che Okaten Wagner with the Saanich tribe told the crowd it was time to change the bank into something peaceful and good.
I believe in the power of each and every one of you to create change. And that's why we're here, to send that message to this bank, send the message to all the people that we are part of the changer, part of the Dokuba, part of creation. We will create something beautiful out of this that is threatening our future.
The Dogli Ba is the supernatural being many Native Americans believe created all things. Referred to by various names, it's called upon to enlist support in confronting challenges in the natural and social world. In this case, the Dogli Ba is being called upon to urge Wells Fargo to divest $467 million from the Dakota Access Pipeline. as Wells Fargo security personnel watched from the sidelines and made sure no one else entered the bank, the crowd formed an oval and continued to chant. "Imagine you're stepping over a stone," said Che O'Katen Wagner.
"That stone, she represents her mother Earth, and that's where our DNA lives.
Heishka, CM. Heishka.
Water is life!
Believe it, Tony!
Water is life!"
Wells Fargo Seattle referred media inquiries to corporate offices in San Francisco. The bank is one of 17 financial institutions worldwide involved in financing the pipeline. In a statement, Wells Fargo said they were contractually obligated to fulfill commitments under the credit agreement so long as the customer is meeting all of its terms and conditions. The Dakota Access Pipeline, which would run from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota down to a terminal in Illinois, is nearly complete, save for a small, crucial portion that would cross beneath the Missouri River. In early December, the Army Corps of Engineers announced it would deny an easement, which would have allowed the pipeline to go under a crossing of the river at Lake Oahe and would prepare an environmental impact statement. This week, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe filed a motion with a U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., asking the court to throw out a Dakota Access Pipeline lawsuit filed against the Army Corps late last year. The lawsuit came on the heels of the Army Corps' announcement that the EIS would consider both the tribe's treaty rights and alternative routes. Meanwhile, the Wells Fargo protest in Seattle moved outside as a mock funeral procession circled the building with a 35-foot-long plastic blow-up pipe. Becca Lips played the part of the funeral director and was
basically giving a eulogy to the death of the pipeline.
She also noted positive things surrounding the pipeline protests, such as
giving the people a chance to unite behind the leadership of the Standing Rock Sioux, to shed a light on, you know, some of these terrible injustices that are happening at the hands of fossil fuel companies.
As darkness fell, the protests moved to the federal building, where a light box displayed the words "Defund DAPL" and "Dump" beside the neon letters of Wells Fargo, the building across the street. Roxanne White from the Nez Perce, Yakima, and Nooksack tribes journeyed to Standing Rock many times last year.
"We're just brothers and sisters, you know, trying to protect the water. Our first sacred medicine. It's always the reason."
The fight to stop the pipeline will continue, she says, but the focus needs to include divesting.
"We have to, like, divest from these big corporations, corporations like Wells Fargo, because they're the ones that are supporting and keeping Dakota Access going. So this is the part that we get to do apart from there, apart from the front lines of Standing Rock."
Matt Remley, a member of the Standing Rock Sioux who lives in Seattle, says divestment is focused on individuals as well as cities. Wells Fargo currently manages the city's $3 billion employee contract. City Council member Kashama Sawant recently introduced an ordinance that would change the process by which the contract is selected to include social justice considerations.
"You know, if it passes, that's a $3 billion per year hit that Wells Fargo is going to be taking over to funding this pipeline."
Remley says the divestment effort has already seen success. Indigenous peoples from Norway who visited Standing Rock last year, the Sami, along with Greenpeace and others, succeeded in getting Norway's largest bank to divest from the pipeline. A recent report from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis predicts more weakness in companies behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. The report concluded the pipeline is an example of overbuild in oil infrastructure in the Bakken region, and as such, risks becoming a stranded asset. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
When you think of America's great constitutional originators, names like Jefferson, Washington, and Franklin come to mind. And of course, Abbott. Last January, Texas Governor Greg Abbott revealed that he has penned 9 new amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Abbott is proposing a bill of sale, effectively transferring our national government from the people to the plutocrats. His tweaks would outlaw government actions that restrain corporate abuse of workers and consumers, while also preventing future Congresses from meeting crucial public needs such as health care, voter rights, and restoration of our national infrastructure. However, Abbott is not the force behind this tampering with our Constitution. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, at the direction of the Koch brothers and their corporate cohorts, wrote Abbott's bill of sale. Back in 2010, ALEC's board of directors approved a resolution calling for a constitutional convention to enact the corporate humbuggery Abbott is now pushing. Convening this convention is a dream of those seeking an American Kochistan, and ALEC is spearheading a hodgepodge of right-wing groups that are close to succeeding. At the convention, they would attempt to rewrite our nation's fundamental governing document. The changes would enthrone the moneyed corporations that Jefferson and other founders abhorred as destroyers of America's democratic possibilities. It takes 34 states to convene a constitutional convention, and 28 states have already passed resolutions to do exactly that. The ALEC Koch Consortium is now targeting 11 others. This is Jim Hightower saying, absurd? Of course. Even the former head of the right-wing Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly, calls this push, quote, a prescription for political chaos. To keep up with ALEC, go to alecexposed.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Nearly 3 years after Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared without a trace in March of 2014, the search has been called off without success. The plane, carrying 239 passengers and crew members, was traveling from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing when it mysteriously went off course and subsequently disappeared. Following this initial disappearance and the media attention, the largest and costliest search in aviation history began. Since July of last year, however, the three governments running the search, Malaysia, China, and Australia, have stated that they would suspend the costly search if no sign of the plane was found in the designated search area, which lies within a patch of the Indian Ocean that spans more than 100,000 square miles. They upheld this promise on Tuesday despite the fact that a report in December recommended that the search area be widened. The search will not continue until specific information on the wreckage's location comes to light. Meanwhile, the families of the 239 people who vanished with the Flight 370 call for answers and claim that the search being called off is irresponsible. However, some believe that this great aviation mystery will remain unsolved until technological advances allow for a more thorough and accurate search.
In a biting attack, Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday accused the Obama administration of trying to undermine President-elect Trump by spreading fake allegations. Putin dismissed a report that Trump engaged in sexual activities with prostitutes at a Moscow hotel. He said it was a part of efforts by Obama's administration to, quote, undermine the legitimacy of the president-elect, despite his convincing victory. Putin's attack highlighted tensions between Moscow and Washington, which have built up over the Ukrainian crisis, the Syrian war, and the allegations of Russian meddling in the U.S. election. Putin also sarcastically suggested that Trump had a better choice for female companionship than Moscow prostitutes, even though he claimed that Russian prostitutes are, quote, the best in the world. At a separate news conference Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow hopes for better relations with the United States once Trump takes office. Lavrov denounced the foreign policies of the Obama administration as messianic attempts to enforce Western values onto the rest of the world, leading to instability and conflicts in the Middle East and elsewhere.
An advertising firm has removed an Australia Day billboard featuring two girls in hijabs from a site in Melbourne after threats were made to the company. The digital sign featured images of people from various cultural backgrounds, and the picture of two Muslim girls holding an Australian flags sparked furious debate among social media users. Hundreds of people from far-right groups, including the United Patriots Front, criticized the image for being, quote, too politically correct, or not a true reflection of Australia Day. Victoria's Multicultural Affairs Minister Robin Scott said the media company chose to take it down due to a number of threats. According to Scott, quote, anyone who considers this a victory needs a refresher on the true meaning of Australia Day. It is about bringing people together and celebrating the diversity which makes this state and the country great.
Let's Last week, the Obama administration ended the wet foot, dry foot immigration policy that for decades allowed Cubans arriving on U.S. shores to apply for legal residency. It's a policy that many would-be immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean cite as unfair, given the preferential treatment in legal immigration it gave to citizens of Cuba. More recently, Haitians with relatives legally residing in the U.S. have had the possibility of coming to the U.S. with humanitarian parole visas. Applicants for those visas have arrived en masse in Tijuana, Mexico, but a surge in applications have created a backlog, effectively stranding thousands of Haitians on the Mexican side of the border. FSR and Andalusian Noel files this report from Tijuana.
Tijuana has long been a key stop along migratory routes into the U.S. It's common to see Central Americans toting light backpacks and the stern faces of Mexicans dumped at the bridge after deportation. But more recently, Haitian nationals have been arriving by the thousands.
Cuando pasó el terremoto.
Among them is James Cherenfant. He left Port-au-Prince after the devastating 2010 earthquake to work in Venezuela. And when that country's economy collapsed, moved on to Brazil.
When the earthquake struck, I lost my business there, my two-story house. Many people in my family died. It was a hard blow. It was very difficult, and my mother said, "There is hardly any life for you here anymore. Go elsewhere."
Thousands of Haitians migrate into Brazil and other South American countries in the aftermath of the earthquake. When the Brazilian and Venezuelan economy started going south, these migrants started heading north, hoping to qualify for U.S. humanitarian parole visas. Cherenfat traveled across 10 countries with his wife and two small children. They are now stuck in Tijuana, awaiting their interviews with U.S. immigration authorities, which may take many months. The humanitarian parole visa program for Haitians started in late 2014 for the purpose of reuniting families with relatives legally residing in the U.S. But applications have skyrocketed since mid-2016, creating a lengthy backlog. Brigitte Pierre traveled the same route as Sharon Fon's family by herself. She first worked in Brazil and later in Chile, but decided to leave for a country closer to her mother and her three-year-old son back in Haiti. Her interview with immigration authorities is scheduled for after Donald Trump's inauguration, but she says she doesn't understand why he would close the door to people like her.
It makes me sad because how can they not receive migrants when there's so much food there and people are dying of hunger? You have to find a way to help others.
Pierre currently lives in a crowded makeshift shelter with a few dozen other Haitian migrants waiting for their paperwork to grind through the gears of bureaucracy. Prior to the start of the influx of Haitian migrants in May of 2016, Tijuana had 5 migrant shelters. There are now over 20. Pat Murphy coordinates one of the pre-existing shelters that used to focus on newly deported Mexicans. He says this is a humanitarian crisis for which various governments are responsible.
U.S. government, first, because they can't process more than 30, 40, 50 people a day. Secondly, the countries of origin, because people have to leave. They can't be taken care of, you know. The disaster in Haiti was over several years, and even though so much money has been invested back in the country, it's still in a disaster zone. We could also blame Brazil a little bit, because they gave visas to these people, to over 40,000 Haitians, and you know, recently with their economic decline, they started basically pushing people out of the country. And then fourth, I think the Mexican government, because they continue to let them into Mexico without any real strategic plan, except to go to the north and hopefully you cross. And, you know, they won't say this publicly, but hopefully you'll cross and you'll be out of our hair.
Pierre, who lives at one of these recently opened shelters, has found work at a pizzeria while living in a sort of migratory limbo.
I will keep waiting even though I don't eat well nor sleep well. But I will keep waiting because I'm still not where I want to be.
That wait doesn't end upon arrival in the U.S. The next stop is often a detention center where applicants await a final decision. The lucky ones will be released to sponsoring relatives. The less fortunate are deported to Haiti. Despite the odds, it's a gamble that's already in process for thousands of Haitians en route from Brazil. Andalusia Noll, Free Speech Radio News, Tijuana, Mexico.
This Friday, America will see a new president take the oath of office. While some will be staying home that evening, Portland Jobs with Justice will be hosting an event called join the resistance, an inauguration night of music and organizing to fight the Trump agenda. Here to speak with us live on the phone is Executive Director of Portland Jobs with Justice, Dee Pei Wu. Dee, are you there?
Yeah, hi, good evening.
Good evening. Thank you so much for joining us on the icy roads. I know are preventing people from coming in, so we really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the phone.
Absolutely, and thank you for having us on the show tonight.
Yeah, so this event, if people haven't seen the picture for your promotion there on Facebook, it has quite an exciting picture. I have to say, as a self-professed Star Wars lover, it's kind of exciting to see the picture there. So you're definitely, I don't know, you are bringing the spirit of the resistance. Why don't we talk about what Join the Resistance is?
Yeah, you know, we wanted to provide a space that was family-friendly and fun, and to also highlight the fact that while we're resisting all the facets of the Trump agenda, it's also really important to build, to have fun, but also it's the creativity that you'll see that evening and throughout the day and throughout the day following. It's that creativity and the joy that is actually what it's going to take to fight the Trump agenda, but also what they're ultimately afraid of is the power of spirit and love and joy and fun in organizing. And folks find that in all different kinds of ways, whether it's through their family, whether it's through music, and when it's through the streets or other kinds of creative expression that we're going to see throughout the next several days and weeks and months and years. And so we wanted to provide a space for that because we'll be in the streets with other folks throughout the days, but we also wanted to provide, you know, lots of other ways to that there's room for everyone in the movement for our rights, for our dignity, and for justice. So that's what's exciting. And then, you know, it's also timely. I think everyone was sort of feeling it, or a lot of our folks were feeling it when Carrie Fisher passed. And we also wanted to, you know, the movie came out and there's a lot of good stuff happening. And so we also wanted to sort of hitch a ride on this particular moment.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about the details of the event, Join the Resistance? It's more than just a concert. It's also a way for people to connect. Can you give us a few of the details about what's going on for this huge event that's going on from 7 to 12 in the evening?
I'm so excited. The event organizer, Jeremy Simmer, he's a volunteer, and he reached out early on to DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, and they agreed to bottom line the night. And then from there, it just kept growing, right? When I've been looking for something creative to sponsor, and when a volunteer stepped up and said, hey, I have this idea, let's make it happen, we just said, yeah, let's roll with this. You know, we're already helping to organize one of the marches on Saturday, but here we are. Let's do something on the 20th. People are going to be really hungry for a place to be in community and with each other. So it's a night of music, and what's going to happen with the music is DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, but then also we have a secret special guest who's a singer-songwriter, and then we have Portland Samba, and we have Love Bomb Go-Go. All of those are those two are marching bands with really sort of high-energy music and percussion, and so it'll just be really good spirits. The organizers of the event include Portland Jobs with Justice, and then other sponsors include Oregon Working Families Party, Basic Rights Oregon, Unite Oregon, formerly the Center for Intercultural Organizing and Oregon Action, Greenpeace, Pacific Northwest, Family Forward Action, the Portland Harbor Community Coalition, Showing Up for Racial Justice Direct Action, group, the Bus Project, Portland Tenants United, and LASE, and a whole bunch of other community organizations. And we really wanted to focus on organizations that have the ability. Oh, and then VOS, of course, Voice Workers Rights Education Project. We really wanted to focus on organizations that have the ability to sort of harness the energy that's been created by this moment since November. You know, everyone's a lot of people who maybe were like, I'm just going to live my life for now, are so excited and so inspired or so motivated to take action right now. And so these are all organizations that are doing really meaningful things right now and have the ability to sort of say, oh, you want to volunteer with us? Let's make it happen. And so all of these organizations have active campaigns and active ways for you to show up for justice and dignity. And so that'll be, and then there's childcare and tabling, so you'll have a chance to meet people, and then you'll have a chance to also you know, really spend it in the company of some really progressive cultural and creative groups that night. It's at the Melody Ballroom at 615 Southeast Alder Street. And we're asking for a donation. This is all volunteer run. It's definitely not in our budget. So we're just trying to raise funds to cover the cost of the event. So we're asking people to donate whatever they can, $5 to $25 suggested donation, but it's also no one will be turned away for lack of funds. The all-ages space with kids activities opens at 6 o'clock p.m., and then from 7 p.m. to midnight will be musical performances in the ballroom. Professional child care will be provided on-site with an RSVP, and we look forward to seeing you all there.
So, you know, you guys are organizing this event, and you were just mentioning that it seems like right now this is a time where a lot of people who would maybe otherwise just sort of sit back are feeling that spirit of needing to engage in community or possibly activism right now. And, you know, that's for many people, that's been inspired by the recent election and people sort of needing to feel active right now. What would you tell people who are considering coming to the event? Like, why is it important right now to engage with these organizations that are already established and involved in our community already?
Yeah, you know, I have to say the organizing that's happening for all of the other public events is so powerful right now. It's just part of this expression of people really feeling like they need to be involved, they need to be do something. And so we totally support that kind of energy. The organizations that are involved are also working at the policy level, right? So there's things that we can do now as activists, like making calls and things like that. But if you really want to see at the table, if you really want to take part in lasting change, and also to feel connected to other folks, I think the established organizations are often a way to do that. They offer, in addition to a way to be active, we often offer training and leadership development as well as a way to sort of hook in and network with already established people and groups. And so it's a way to build a larger movement that has lots of room for people of all different abilities, ages, races, genders, and gender presentations, and also levels of experience, skill, and interest, right? So in the movements that I've been part of in the past, it's really important to have, you know, places for artists and organizers and faith leaders and students and academics, as well as activists and organizers and parents, you know. And so that's what we're trying to create, is the big tent kind of space that lets everyone feel connected, and that there's, it's sort of, you know, the Rumi poem, but also Unitarian Universalists also have this saying about come as you are, right? There's room for you in this space. And that's what we're trying to create on Friday night.
Your event very much reminds me of Portland Jobs with Justice itself, where you're not just one organization, you're actually a coalition of, what is it, like 100 organizations?
Yes, we've grown over the past year, so we're over 120 at this point at last count of sort of organizations that commit to workers' rights and economic justice through a racial justice and gender justice lens.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more for people who maybe are unfamiliar with Portland Jobs with Justice about what is the mission?
The mission of Portland Jobs with Justice is just that, to really bring people together, you know, faith institutions and faith leaders with unions and labor organizations, with community organizations that are that can be racial justice, LGBTQ rights, a whole host of other issues. Some environmental organizations, and then student organizations. It's really to bring people together to create this idea of a movement that's bigger than all of us. We also have what we call the Solidarity Pledge, which is the idea that, you know, assuming that you have, you know, the issues that are sort of primary for your life and well-being, that you commit to show up 5 times a year for somebody else's struggle, recognizing that the way that we learn about each other and that we grow together is to be present and be with each other. So that's part of the sort of modus operandi, the MO of Portland Jobs with Justice, is that we support you when you're asking for it and when you call, and then that, you know, you come out and support people in their issues however they need support, whether it's a letter or a phone call or showing up for a court date or out in the streets. that we show up for each other in all different kinds of ways throughout the year.
You know, pardon. Right now you have a lot of campaigns going on. You have a campaign about globalization and healthcare, immigrant rights, the campaign for 15. As this new administration is about to come in, does Portland Jobs with Justice, does this new administration give you guys any sort of pause where you're rethinking how you have to be approaching these campaigns right now, or is it just we have to continue to fight harder?
I think it's a both and kind of a situation. Some things that were sort of on a downswing, like, you know, healthcare as an issue, are certainly all of a sudden like more relevant than they have been in a long time because of the attempts to repeal the ACA and so the Affordable Care Act, which people are also calling Obamacare. So that feels, you know, so there have been some shifts. We know that public sector labor unions are some of the biggest threats to corporate control of our economy, of policymaking and everything like that. We thought we got, you know, in February of last year, we thought we got a little bit of breathing space against sort of the thing that would be the death knell for public sector unions. And we did, but now with this new administration, I think we're anticipating that the threats to people's rights to organize at work and the are going to be really heightened and increased more than ever. I know that some of our national, federal level politicians think that LGBTQ rights is sort of secure, and but I think when you talk to LGBTQ advocates who've been through decades and decades of activism, I think we're very clear that whether the attack comes from the private sector or comes through a policy lens, LGBTQ rights will be one of the sectors that's really, really under attack. But we're also starting some community, we're participating in a lot of the organizing around community defense squads. We think that that's really important because people organized in their neighborhoods are the best means of community defense because you're close, right? And so that's one of the things that we'll be holding training for folks